From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the subterranean layers of eastern Africa. We turn our attention to an animal known as the sand puppy, but more commonly known throughout the science world as the naked mole rat. It is unequivocally the ugliest creature you could find, looking like an overcooked hot dog with two protruding buck teeth. Yes, it's easy to assume that this animal shares nothing useful for humans, but it turns out this animal is inspiring the greatest hope for cancer researchers. The naked mole rat, remarkably resistant to tumors, and thanks to a team at the University of Rochester Medical Center, we're finally learning much more about why that is. But it's not just the naked mole rat. Yes, the maybe much less cancer-resistant mice can help us understand. Even fruit flies offer hope. What an interesting basis for our monthly science roundtable, and that is where we start. We welcome three people to our panel this month. We start with Vera Gorbanova, a professor of biology, an associate professor of oncology, and the co-director of the Aging Research Center. Easy for me to say. Vera, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Andrei Siluanov is an assistant professor of biology at URMC. Andrei, how are you?
Fine.
Thanks for being here. Dirk Bowman is a professor of biomedical genetics and the co-director of the Aging Research Center. Dirk, how are you?
Very good, Evan. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. Dirk, before we even branch off and talk about these specific creatures and animals that might help us, what is the mission of the Aging Research Center?
Well, aging research over the last 10, 20 years has really gotten into a phase where we understand at a much more mechanistic level what happens as we get older. Rochester has for many years been prominent as a place where aging research, particularly in the geriatric field, has been going on. But scientists, both in the School of Arts and Sciences, notably Vera and Andrei, as well as in the medical school, have done very successful research in unraveling the molecular mechanisms that cause aging. And so now we're at a stage where we can try to understand how aging contributes to many diseases. We know that aging is actually probably the most prevalent risk factor for a whole slew of diseases, including the big killers, cancer, cardiovascular disease, neurodegeneration. And we have some ideas what makes that happen and how we can get a molecular and cell biological handle on these events and try to understand it better, with the ultimate goal, of course, to slow down aging and develop that as, if you will, the ultimate preventive medical strategy.
So to live longer, but to live better, yeah?
Mostly better. Mm-hmm. I think aging research really now comes to a stage where we understand at a causal mechanistic level how aging influences our susceptibility to all kinds of maladies. And that's why it's so important that people who are interested in the fundamental processes underlying aging talk to medical researchers and physician scientists that deal with patients afflicted by these diseases and try to find common ground and a communal understanding of how aging affects disease and how we might actually use that knowledge to help people.
So I want to ask Vera and Andre to sort of give us a brief overview of what you're working on now, and then I do want to backtrack a bit, because if you're into science research, most of our listening audience who's really excited about this probably has heard of the naked mole rat by now, and we can talk about, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it correctly, hyaluronan? Is that the right term?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yes.
Okay. Vera's looking at me as if I'm the first person who's outside of the science field who's pronounced it correctly, but we're going to talk about that. Also want to talk about the latest that we're looking at, different kinds of, well, the way our bodies react to aging. And when I read Vera and Andre's work, I think of it like if you buy new shoes and you walk around and your shoe gets untied, think of your DNA sort of structures being broken and repaired. You keep retying your shoes, no big deal. But eventually, the shoelaces may start to fray. And if they break entirely, maybe you use duct tape to hold your shoe together, and eventually your shoe is just going to fall off. And reading your work when it comes to mice and mole rats makes me think that something in our DNA early in life reacts very well to sort of fixing it. But over time, that breaks down, and we have to figure out why, and how do we prolong the effectiveness of repairing our own DNA? Is that Is that a fair analogy?
Yes, that's exactly right, because our bodies, they don't just wear and tear. So we have this capacity to repair, but this capacity declines as we get older, and this opens up, you know, this whole slew of diseases of aging, for which increasing age is the biggest risk factor, like for cancer, for cardiovascular disease. So exactly what we are studying is we're looking for those mechanisms that control the repair and how we can prevent it from declining with age. And here, the help of various organisms that we study is extremely important, because mice age much faster than naked mole rats. And by comparing these two species, we can identify specific genes that are important for slower aging.
All right, so a mouse has a life expectancy of how many years?
About 3.
And the naked mole rat about 30.
Exactly, 10 times longer life.
Are we assuming that that is entirely attributable to the naked mole rat's resistance to disease? Most of it?
Well, it's slow aging, so it's a question, you know, what's the cause and what's the consequences.
Sure.
So we believe that because naked mole rats age slower, so they're less susceptible to disease. So we are looking for those clues how to slow down the aging process, and then we will slow down the onset of diseases.
And Andre, when it comes to this kind of research, occasionally it's difficult. Well, it's always difficult to get the proper funding. But right now, my understanding is sort of a 5-year project, and there are things that are happening that will allow this research to continue. Give us a snapshot of what's happening right now.
Yeah, past year, actually, Vera was able to organize this big project grant, and she was a PI, and I was a co-PI on this grant, and it was focused on the comparative genomics of aging, because the idea of that grant actually to understand this mechanism of longer lifespan for some species, and as Vera said, we have a collection of actually over 20 different rodent species with different lifespan and different predisposition to age-related disease like a cancer. We have 2 species of a naked mole rat and a blind mole rat who is extremely resistant to cancer. It means, and this proposal actually to identify the genes, to identify the pathway which allow these animals to live long. And it's a collaboration between University of Rochester, our 2 labs, Albert Einstein and Harvard Medical Center. It means we are trying to approach it from different angles, DNA repair, the genomic approach, and cell biology, what our part of what we are doing, and to uncover these genes.
All right, so with naked mole rats, do they get cancer on their own in the wild?
No, they don't. And
they just don't?
They're cancer-proof.
Cancer-proof. I mean, you're laughing, Dirk. Is there a reason you're laughing at that description?
No, it's correct. It's a nice way of putting it.
It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It says that it's possible in principle. There's no inescapable necessity that multicellular organisms get cancer. And so that's really a fundamental insight of this kind of research. And the big challenge is to find out what the difference is and whether we can somehow get a handle on these mechanisms that protect naked mole rats.
Okay, and so this is where I want the update, because I've been reading for about the past 18 months or so about something called hyaluronan. And my understanding is this. Hyaluronan is a very important goo. I say goo because that's how it was described in the New York Times. In the New York Times, that's a very technical term. But naked mole rats have longer hyaluronan, but human beings have it too. So the good news is we're starting with something that is already in humans and maybe can be added to humans, Vera?
Yeah, you are exactly right. Hyaluronan is present in our bodies, so it's in our skin and joints and the blood vessels, but it's a polysaccharide, so it's like a long chain of sugars connected together. And in the naked mole rat, it's 6 to 10 times longer. And this results in different properties of the molecule, and it can act on early premalignant cells and stop them from proliferation. And possibly it can also prevent heart disease by being an antioxidant, by neutralizing reactive oxygen species that are formed in the heart and the brain. So this may be a big contributor to disease resistance of the naked mole rat. And what I want to say, again, you brought up very important point that it's something that we already have. It just this mechanism is not quite developed in humans. So that's, I think, the power of studying variety of species is that different species evolve different adaptations for long life and for health. And if some humans are missing some of them, but we could still import them, once we learn the molecular mechanism, then we could import them and make a drug or a treatment for human beings.
When you talk about import them, we're talking about injections? We're talking about pill form? What are we talking about?
Either or. So we could either administer this high molecular weight hyaluronan, but then it will be more topical application, or we can develop some small molecule drugs that will modify the way hyaluronan is handled by our body, so we could increase endogenous hyaluronan, our own hyaluronan, just, you know, modify metabolism so that there will be more of it in our bodies.
Okay, and my understanding also is that in some cases we're already using hyaluronan in humans for other ailments, not for the purpose of cancer prevention, but for other ailments as well, is that correct?
Yes, it is currently in use, so it is a part of arthritis injections, mm-hmm. because it has anti-inflammatory lubricating properties, so it's injected in osteoarthritis knees. It also used as a lubricant, it used in eye surgery, mm-hmm. it also part of cosmetic creams. But before our findings, people didn't pay much attention to the length of the molecule. So what's currently being used is kind of short. Well, it's still beneficial, but we believe that if we go to those extremely long lengths, as found in the naked mole rat, we can expand the utility of it also to anti-cancer and other applications.
All right. So if we think we can apply hyaluronan to humans, and again, that's down the road with more testing, is the first testing to find out if this treatment works in regular mice?
Actually, yeah, we have right now actually mice already constructed like a month ago, transgenic mice, which carries the gene responsible for the production of the naked mole rat long chain hyaluronic acid. And right now we're in the process of characterization of those mice, because we hope that probably these mice will be cancer resistant and maybe longer lived. And what type of a cancer is it? All type of the cancer or any specific types? It means it's really a work in progress.
Okay, so you've got the naked mole rat, which just doesn't get cancer. You think hyaluronan is related. You have the regular mouse, which is very susceptible to tumors. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you do is you take the hyaluronan and you see if you can essentially transfer that in a way to mice and see if there's a corresponding drop in tumors and cancers, et cetera. How long, give me a sense for the research time, how big of a sample size do you need to feel confident in these kind of results?
I think with the mice, probably within 2-3 years, we'll know if it works as a proof of principle. But then, of course, for developing a human drug, the pathway is much longer. But again, it's a foreseeable future.
Let me also ask the question that some people may have, and this is sort of a much broader question about aging. But if I have a relative who is getting older and either may have cancer or is susceptible to cancer or we have family histories of it, why will I wait till a drug is marketed? Why can't I say, Dirk, Vera, Andre, sign me up for whatever you're creating. I'm on a trial. I'll sign a waiver that says I don't need it FCC approved. Because if you think this can work, let's start rolling it out. Is that unrealistic?
No, that's kind of how medical research works, right? There are at the medical center at University of Rochester at all times a number of different clinical trials ongoing. And if you go to the website or if you're interested in a specific disease, you can contact the medical center, the Wilmot Cancer Center, or places like that. And they will be able to tell you what clinical trials are currently accepting patients. And yes, sometimes you have access to experimental drugs that are not yet on the market and have often amazing results. We have seen tremendous successes in the general field of medicine that was inspired by a molecular understanding of causes and principles of diseases, such as drugs that really very effectively cause cancer remission by targeting specifically altered gene products with targeted therapies. And these types of research projects and clinical trials are going on, and I encourage everybody who is in that situation to reach out to research universities that are associated with medical centers where these studies are going on.
And by the way, I think the next question then becomes, do we have any reason to suspect that injections or pill forms of hyaluronan in human beings could have side effects that we don't know of yet, or any deleterious effects? Do we know?
Well, we will know it once we study it in mice, and this is why this proof of principle is important, that once we bring a certain mechanism from naked mole rats into a different species, what will happen? There is one more example of a mammalian organism with overproduction of hyaluronan, and this is the Sharpei dog. So it's a dog with this loose, wrinkly skin, and they overproduce hyaluronan, and they're generally healthy.
So the Sharpei, which always looks like a dog that should be 10 times larger because of the amount of skin it has, is in the same family as the naked mole rat. Not in the same family. But it is similar because the naked mole rat needs some of that excess skin because of its subterranean travels. Is it possible that it developed more hyaluronan, which is related to that, and it just was a happy accident of nature that it happens to be cancer preventing?
You are exactly right. So that's, we believe, how that happened. When naked mole rats adapted to subterranean lifestyle, they first developed hyaluronan for the loose skin to squeeze through the tunnels, and then it was co-opted for other useful purposes. We also find hyaluronan overproduction in the blind mole rat that is not a close relative of naked mole rat. We also found it in moles, which are a different clade of mammals. But not in humans. We don't live underground, and this is why we didn't develop it. But this is why we can probably benefit.
I wonder if those hairless cats also have hyaluronan.
Probably not.
But how interesting. So we're seeing that characteristic may be sometime down the line, but there's a possibility there. Then I look at the very, very latest news and something called SIRT6, which is being studied not in naked mole rats, but in mice, is that correct? And my understanding of SIRT6 is it's kind of a dual-purpose item that helps repair broken DNA molecules, but it also sort of prevents these jumping genes or these problematic parts of us from sort of spreading. And the older we get, the more SIRT6 has to simply do the work of retying our shoes and helping the DNA get fixed. But then, you know, you call it out of the room to go deal with the broken DNA, and it's not around when the jumping genes want to get out. Yep. And it can't function as both. Is that fair?
Yes, that's exactly right. SIRT6 is a fascinating gene because if you mutate, mice live much shorter. If you give mice extra portion of it, they live a little bit longer. And it controls many processes that are important for aging, and one of them is keeping those genomic parasites in check. So what we find that in older mice, those genomic parasites, transposons, they start moving around, and they wreak havoc in our genome. So again, it would be really important to find out how we can tidy this up and prevent this process of activation of parasites as we get older.
Okay, so can we simply, I'm filled with these kind of questions that, I don't know, half the time Dirk is looking at me and sort of laughing a little bit, but you know, it's exciting. We're all excited about this.
We are excited about it too.
It's easy for us to have questions like, hey, if SIRT6 is such an important factor, and if it becomes preoccupied with repairing DNA the older we get, and it's so functional in stopping the spread of things that are troublesome, can we just simply add more SIRT6? And is that something that is injectable or pill form, et cetera?
Yeah, we are also working on that. So we are making a mouse that will have even more SIRT6 and also more active SIRT6. So we will see if there will be any side effects of that. But we are optimistic. Of course, finding a drug that will activate certain enzyme is more difficult than finding something that inhibits it. But again, it's possible, and I think with more research we'll get there.
And I'm seeing a few comments online, and Gordon is asking, he says, fascinating stuff. He wants to know if the substance we were talking about with the naked mole rat, if you take it out of the naked mole rat, does the naked mole rat then get diseases like cancer?
Actually, yeah, we did this kind of experiments. It was in our Nature paper when we actually took the naked MORAD cells, and when you try to transform it to the cancer cells, they're quite resistant. But when you inactivate the enzymes who are responsible for production of hyaluronic acid, then these animal cells become cancerous. It means this molecule is really essential for the cancer protection of naked MORADs.
Okay, so the answer then is yes.
Yes, definitely.
Yes, absolutely.
You take hyaluronin, or at least in the way that naked mole rats have it, out, and they become all of a sudden susceptible to cancer when they were not. And Miss T online corrects me. I think I said FCC when I meant FDA. It's nice to have fact checkers on Twitter. I mistook a little alphabet soup there. I see that our phones, Dave, our phones, I know some people have been wanting to call the program. If you're patient with us, we're going to get the phones. We're going to get to the phones later in the hour and the Science Roundtable. Talking to Vera Gorbanova, professor of biology and associate professor of oncology and the co-director of the Aging Research Center at URMC, Dirk Bowman, who's a professor of biomedical genetics and the co-director of the Aging Research Center, and Andrei Siluanov, an assistant professor of biology, been working with Vera on this fascinating research. And so we're looking at these substances that seem to offer huge clues into why our bodies, as we get older, become more susceptible to aging, more susceptible to disease. And Vera, what's next when it comes to SIRT6, this material that, again, provides that dual role of repairing DNA, but also then stopping sort of these genomic parasites from jumping? What research needs to be done now to be sure that we're looking at the right thing and we can use it perhaps in human development?
Well, first we want to find out exactly which function of SIRT6 is important for long life, because it suppresses parasites, it promotes repair of DNA molecules, it also has other functions in metabolism, so we want to find which one. And then we want to find how to stimulate it, how to make either more active form or find an activator of SIRT6. And again, we will use mice with more active version of SIRT6, and we will see if they become healthier, if they live longer. And of course, the next step will be to think how this could be transferred to human beings.
Dirk, when it comes to some of the larger questions that people have about aging and frankly about disease and death, I'm always interested that some people will say we're interfering with the natural processes that are actually vital, that unfortunately disease and death are vital to the human species, and that we don't want to interfere too much with that. And as you help lead the research at the Center on Aging, how do you grapple with that kind of a question?
Well, I think if you accept death and mortality as a natural process, then maybe we shouldn't have hospitals. we are definitely of the opinion that it's our mission to make life healthier and more comfortable for people, and that's something that society is willing to support, and that's what we're doing. I think I want to pick up a little bit on Vera's comments on SIRT6. I think it's a great example for what aging research has done and where the excitement really came from over the last 10, 20 years, because it showed that not only do we have an understanding of the molecular mechanisms underlying the aging process, as we have now stressed a few times, but that indeed, by relatively simple manipulations, the activation of a gene product or the overexpression of one molecule, we can make at least experimental animals live longer and healthier. Studies have been published recently. We had a great talk here in our Aging Research Day, which is an annual event sponsored by our center, about trials on monkeys that had been on different diets and shown that really there is definitely a perspective for making people live longer, or multicellular organisms live longer and healthier. And so the goal of basic aging research is to understand these type of mechanisms, to understand the switches that tell the organism to invest more into upkeep and to maintain us in a healthier shape, so that we are protected longer from these age-associated diseases. And then, as Vera suggested, to use that information to develop new strategies to deal with these, or maybe to engage these switches so that we would benefit in terms of a healthier, longer, more productive, and more enjoyable life.
Paul online is asking about whether this means that our susceptibility to tumors and cancer later in life is more a function of luck, that do our bodies have certain substances or more of it? Could Vera and Andre have differing levels of hyaluronan or SIRT6, or do we all have the same? Do we know the answer to that?
Well, there is a lot of variability between individuals. So some people...
Individual human beings.
Human beings, the individual animals. So some people are more susceptible to certain diseases than others. Some people age faster. Some people age slower. But overall, age is the greatest risk factor for cancer. So, of course, there is also room for studying, like at Albert Einstein College, they study centenarians, so those people that live over 100, mm-hmm. and looking for genes in these people that ensure slow aging, and we look across species or in model organisms. So there are many approaches, and I think aging research in the past decade, it really developed, so it's booming now, and we are trying to attract more science and, you know, more funding to it.
Would we expect to find more hyaluronan and SIRT6 in centenarians?
That's a very good question. We haven't looked, but we are actually in the process of collaborating with Albert Einstein College, mm-hmm. and we're asking exactly that question.
I would also like to comment on the question that the listener just had, that I think it was, is it a matter of luck whether you get cancer at old age or not? So are we already doomed if we are in the worst part of the population? But there's certainly something there. We have clearly families where cancer is more prevalent than others. But we also find that certain changes, lifestyle, dietary manipulations, and maybe drugs can influence or can stack the deck a little bit in your favor, even if you belong to a group that might not be as fortunate as others in terms of, you know, having high levels of SIRT6 or hyaluronan or cancer preventive genes. And that is definitely one of the more promising perspectives of aging research.
Does that mean when we talk about diet, for example, mm-hmm. we talk about, well, diet and exercise, which are mm-hmm. at the core of any sort of health, but especially when it comes to disease and even cancer, does that mean that our diet could impact the way, yeah, and again, I'm. It's amazing to me reading your research. I never thought about just breaking DNA and repairing it and these things. Does a bad diet strain our body and force it to repair DNA and sort of overwork, say, SIRT6 earlier than it should?
Oh, yes. So diet has tremendous effects. So diet can promote DNA damage, or it can promote those mechanisms that repair DNA damage. So there are many dietary recommendations out there, but very few of them are based on serious science. And again, what now many people are researching is exactly what diet is better on the molecular level. So monkeys are being put on a variety of diets with different ratios of protein to carbohydrates. And what we want to learn is how it affects the longevity, susceptibility to disease. So something beyond just losing a few pounds, but actually to get deeper understanding in how it affects biological processes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So we all know that eating healthy and exercising is good for us, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about whatever, eating broccoli or drinking red wine, but a real mechanistic understanding of how individual components or mixtures of foods will affect the way our DNA defense mechanism works, the way in which our guts are populated with microbes that can be beneficial or not, just being able to put the finger on this and say, look, this is actually what happens, this is why we have to do it, and this is what we have to look for if we want to develop really rational recommendations is very important. I was just talking to Peter here about another example for this, the Nobel Prizes that were announced today. So for those of you who haven't heard this, it is a very exciting line of research where a team of researchers has identified a very specific neuronal mechanism that gives us some kind of an internal GPS, so we understand how we orient ourselves. And I found this interesting because in the medical center we have a lot of research going on Alzheimer's, and it turns out that losing your way is one of the first signs that you might actually succumb to that. And so now we have a cell biological reason that explains this effect. So in the medical center, for example, if you go in and say, here, my aunt might act a little funny and we are worried that she might have Alzheimer's, one of the things they do is ask her to find her way to the gift shop and come back. And it's surprising. Sometimes they can't do this. It's a very simple thing. And so I think it's a good example for a phenomena that we knew for a long time, but now through the work by the Drs. Moser and O'Keefe, who got the Nobel Prize today, we understand what happens, and we can work on trying to work our way backwards into the molecular causes and maybe to find disease strategies to deal with this.
You called it an internal GPS kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And we can think of all kinds of folks in our lives who occasionally get confused. That doesn't necessarily mean that Alzheimer's is, it could be for any number of reasons.
Absolutely not. But it's one of these things that happens more and more frequently yeah. as you get older. Obviously, 20-year-olds can get cancer, but the frequency with which that happens
sure.
rises exponentially with age. And we are now in a position to say, okay, these and these and these are mechanisms that contribute to this. Could be SIRT6, could be tumor suppressors, could be BRCA1, all of these things. And that type of mechanistic understanding brought together with people who really see the patients is incredibly powerful and is something that is hopefully becoming more efficient as we move forward with our aging center.
Yeah, I have a 2.5-year-old son. I can't imagine the world he's going to inherit when he's 50, 60, 70, 80, what the expectation will be. I mean,
well,
even the smartest people in the room, can you imagine, Vera?
Well, I think we are really living in a very exciting time because aging research, so there has been so much progress. So we are, I think, at this time where we can really make the difference. So people start living longer and longer. So now maximum lifespan that's been recorded in history is 122 years. So there was a French lady that lived that long. So no one has surpassed that, but I think it will happen in the next century. This is going to happen once we find how to slow down aging mechanism, make people live longer and healthier, we'll get there. So I think for our children, it will be a very exciting time. And this is why, you know, we formed the Aging Center because Rochester has been we had very strong program in aging research, but we decided, you know, to really bring us all together and form this center that, combines the School of Medicine and Dentistry and the college will really give us this, momentum to develop it further. And so we just formed this year officially. And I would like also to use this opportunity to make an announcement that in May next year, we are planning a big inaugural event for the Aging Center, and we want to invite members of the community, so we'll be advertising it. And there we'll speak and we'll try to explain again the importance of aging research and importance of supporting aging research, so we will see the difference in our lifetime, or our children's lifetime.
Does this mean, by the way, that the old retirement age of 62 and a half or 65 is probably going to have to go out the wayside if we're going to be living longer and better?
I think that's going to happen no matter what. It's just up to us.
Just based on the economy, yes.
It's up to us to make it enjoyable and practical for people to be productive longer.
Let's take about a 60-second break, and we're going to continue the conversation. It's our monthly science roundtable as we hear from the Aging Research Center, Vera Gorbanova, Dirk Bowman, Andrei Solovanov, talking about this remarkable new research on various levels that tell us how our bodies age, and what we might learn from other species. We're going to continue with the Science Roundtable next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, is Halloween a fun one-night experience, or can it harm kids' eating habits? And for parents who work hard to get their kids to appreciate real food, what's the alternative to the celebration of junk food that happens at the end of October? Our panel looks at Halloween alternatives with a realistic view of how the holiday impacts kids. It's next hour on Connections.
Opening this week at The Little, Trax, starring Mia Wasikowska and Adam Driver, tells the true story of Robin Davidson, a young woman who undertook an incredibly dangerous solo trek across 1,700 miles of Australian outback. A National Geographic photographer follows her journey, but really, it's Davidson, her dog, and four camels breaking the threshold between her, the outback, and a life-changing walk. See details for tracks at thelittle.org.
Okay, I just want to mention a couple of things here. If you want to join the program, you can call the program here. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're going to get to the phones in a moment here. If you've got questions on aging, the latest research, and really the future of aging, so much of this research is being led right here in Rochester at various institutions, and I probably mixed some of the species when I introduced Vera and Dirk and Andre. So in terms of background here, Vera, just real briefly, just because the host cares to be accurate here.
Yes, so we are affiliated with the University of Rochester, which is a College of Arts, Science, and Engineering, Andre Siluanov and myself. And Dirk Bowman is affiliated, well, University of Rochester, but School of Medicine and Dentistry. And our aging center actually brings those units together. So it's a cross-campus initiative.
Okay, I see. So we have, we've got sort of genomic jumping happening, and the aging center is the CERT 6 that would have prevented that, but now it's sort of broken down and we have this combination. Okay, I understand.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Very good. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can also do it online at Evan Dawson. And we have various questions coming in online. We have Paul asking again, following up, just kind of wants to know if we're eventually going to have tests to know how much of each one of us has in our body of these different materials. In other words, I think he's asking, can we foresee a day in the future where, let's say your family has a history of Alzheimer's and your family has a history of cancer and heart disease. Certainly, number one, we have to have a solid diet and exercise regime. And there's so many variables, it's hard to know exactly what can cause it. But will we eventually have tests for some of these different substances in our bodies to find out, well, you happen to have lower levels of CERT 6, or you have lower levels of hyaluronan or other things at an early age. Is that possible?
Yes, it is. And there is a lot of effort going into that. It's personalized medicine. So once, technology is getting there. So very soon it will be quite feasible to sequence everybody's genome and find genetically if there are certain genes, that may promote, faster aging or lower levels of some essential enzymes, and then you can actually take steps to correct it by diet or maybe pharmacological interventions. So there is a lot of research directing into developing such tests.
And Dirk, you wanted to weigh in that as well?
Absolutely. So as Vera mentioned, personalized medicine is a new kind of research, a kind of medical strategy. It's also often referred to as precision medicine because it's really a very targeted approach to diseases that looks at the individual patient in much more detail than we ever could do before. And it involves DNA sequencing technology, but also looking at biochemical profiles, presumably including things like hyaluronic acids. And the medical center, for example, right now is massively investing into expanding personnel, research, and resources to enable us to offer these type of personalized medicine services to patient populations. And there's a lot of excitement about that. Certainly in the area of cancer research, you are already able to much better predict which therapies will be successful and which might cause more harm than good. And in many places around the world, these type of approaches are implemented. And again, the strategy is based on a fundamentally increased understanding of what diseases are at a molecular level, what happens in cells as you get cancer, and what are the predictors of these different diseases, who is at risk and who would benefit from certain therapies. And aging research, as well as basic cancer research, neurobiology, all of these things feed into the development of these very forward-looking therapy approaches that are very rapidly developing at the University of Rochester Medical Center, but really in all places around the world.
Yeah, so it's very important to develop such tests. We need to know exactly which genes to look for, what markers, and this is what basic research is doing, finding those genes that control aging or those compounds, and then we can measure them.
And Vera and Andre, especially when it comes to work on things like naked mole rats, people like me see your work and they say, let's go, let's speed this up, let's, you know, let's get an injectable to the overnight onto the market tomorrow. I mean, Andre, there's a little bit of an impatience that gets associated with great news. I mean, there's so much really interesting and very frankly good news coming out of your research, but I think there's probably impatience in the general public.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's very exciting to do this kind of research, but originally when we just initiated our research on naked mole, the blind mole, it was very difficult to get the funding, especially from NIH, because for them it's some kind of boutique creatures which you have no relevance to human aging. But since we discovered all these genes and all the molecules, the hyaluronic acid, we got really the interest from the naked from the NIH, and we got the money for this. And right now we're in the rolling actually to find the mechanisms how it's possible to transfer to humans.
Well, it's you know, you won't believe it, but the budget of the National Institute on Aging is just 3% of the total budget of National Institute of Health. So we really have to do a lot of work to convince policymakers that if we learn how to slow down aging, we will slow down many, many diseases of old age. And this is what keeps it, you know, the progress from happening. It slows down the pace at which we
Has it always been such a small portion of the budget? Aging research has always been sort of not prioritized, it seems.
I think that's true. It used to be a much more descriptive science that people didn't take quite as seriously. You know, and people had the idea that old age is just something that happens, that's inevitable. It's like a car, you know, a lot of things have to work and one of them will break and there's nothing you can do about it. But modern aging research really tells us a different story, and namely that there are indeed manipulations such as activating SIRT6 that has the systemic effect that can prolong aging in all its complexity.
And doesn't seem to have deleterious side effects.
Not that we can tell. So it's that's really what caused a lot of excitement and what got people very interested in aging research, myself included, right? I had been working originally on fundamental questions of gene regulation and the way the organism deals with oxidative stress. And then about 10 years ago, when I moved, after I'd moved to Rochester, I discovered this very, very exciting and promising field and moved into that. And it's been a fun ride.
And some of your work, Dirk, from what I've read, and please correct me here, but you've looked at how cells end up in sort of an antioxidant defense mode. And we hear about antioxidants, and I don't know if research is conclusive into the effects of antioxidants. Yeah. Do we know about that yet?
So that's a very good question. So people have actually pointed their finger at oxidative stress as one of the main drivers of aging for many decades. And surprisingly, that understanding hasn't really yielded a clear approach to deal with it. So our research tries to understand this a little better. And as always, the story is more complicated than that. And purely ramping up antioxidant molecules in your body will not help, because that has deleterious side effects that are undesirable. So we are trying to understand in simple organisms. So we use the fruit fly Drosophila to...
The fruit fly.
The fruit fly, exactly. Yeah. What you find on the bananas at Wegmans. One of the most prominent biological genetic model organisms, which has remarkable similarity to us, I have to say. So it's a very useful model for aging. Again, they live even shorter than mice. They live about 2 months, and so we can observe the aging process. And what we find is we understand now at the molecular level why the ability of an aging organism to deal with oxidative stress breaks down. And that's what's happening. And we are working on regimens for these animals to kind of exercise their antioxidant mechanisms, and it seems to be working. So it's very exciting stuff.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, antioxidants could have side effects that are undesirable, as in we don't want to just overload on antioxidants?
That's right. So it's not good enough to just fill up on vitamin C or vitamin E or something like that. That might have benefits in an acute challenge situation, but not to prevent aging overall. So what we want to do is help the organism itself to deal with oxidative stress challenges and to mount the proper responses to maintain the equilibrium of the antioxidant and protective mechanisms from things that allow the organism to work properly.
So deal with oxidative stress
when it comes.
When it comes, yeah. As opposed to eating 6 pounds of blueberries a day and saying that's all antioxidants and we're good to go.
That's
well,
pretty
blueberries
much the
may
idea.
May be good, but you know, purified forms of vitamins, well, they have been associated with actually adverse effects.
Interesting. Yeah. Has anybody at this table had the product known as Soylent? Have you heard about this? The nutrient product that the West Coast venture capitalists, they thought that the notion of food was too cumbersome and too expensive, and so they essentially purchased all of the nutrients and distilled it into sort of a chalk-like beverage, and they call it Soylent, as a nod to Soylent Green as people. But the idea being that you can just take the individual components and...
Well, I would say it's a dangerous path to go, because we don't precisely understand which nutrients we need. So, well, no, when we think we understand, so for example, a few years ago, people thought, well, antioxidant is great, so let's all take vitamin A, and people were taking it, and they were developing higher risk of cancer from that. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to do more research to know exactly what, you know, this concentrated diet could be.
We have a few more minutes here as we talk about aging and the work that's happening and the three people in the room doing so much work to help us understand how we age. Danielle is asking, is hyaluronan related to hyaluronic acid, an ingredient in supplements for joint pain and skin care taken from the soil in Japan? That's Danielle asking on Twitter.
It's not in soils, actually. Okay. It is some of the roots that contains the high concentration of the hyaluronic acid, and some like rooster corns, they have the kind of high concentration of hyaluronic acid.
Yeah, so hyaluronan and hyaluronic acid is the same thing, just to be clear. Indeed, it is found in all those cosmetic preparations and for joint health.
Skin care as well, Daniel?
Skin care as well, yes.
Interesting.
It just, what we found in the naked mole rat, it's basically the same unit of the molecule, but it's much longer chain, so many more units of this molecule, and it has superior properties to the shorter one.
And Aaron is asking on Twitter, there's almost no such thing as cancer in muscle. Could some of the answer already be in our muscles?
There are actually muscle cancers, so... maybe they're a little less prevalent than the well-known cancers, breast and prostate and stuff. But yeah, there are definitely muscles that arise from cancers that arise from muscle cells. Yeah.
And muscle cells, mature muscle cells cannot divide anymore. So this is why they're less likely to grow into a tumor. But we have many cells, we have many tissues where we need cells to divide to sustain the tissue, and this is where the greatest risk of cancer occurs. So it would be difficult to directly take the lesson from non-dividing cells and bring it to cells that need to proliferate.
Just a couple of minutes left here. We've been hearing about research that's happening, and we always hear about mice, but the naked mole rat, fruit fly, these are not things that human beings would immediately associate with us, and yet... We're hearing, obviously, that is the case. Has the scientific community embraced this kind of research? Has the scientific community put its arms around the naked mole rat, for example, and said, yes, there are parallels that we can learn from here?
Well, I think it's happening right now. So when we were starting work on naked mole rat, say, 7 years ago, it was almost impossible for us to get funding from the government to do that.
There was just skepticism?
Skepticism, yeah. Right. I mean, could you really get concrete mechanisms from studying these animals? But we've proven that we can. So I think the momentum is there, but there is still a lot of convincing we need to do.
Andre?
Actually, recently we just came from the big agent meeting at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. And that's the first time they organized the comparative biology studies symposium with smolts. And it's really important because, you know, we want to see the engine mechanism of different species. And that's really the recognition of the community.
All right. Let me wrap with this. At the end of this year, we're going to be doing a show where we look at 25 years into our future, what will have changed scientifically and how it will apply to our lives. Vera, from the work we're seeing, what do you expect 25 years from now?
Well, we'll probably know a lot more about aging. We'll know specific genes, and hopefully we'll be working on the interventions, how to slow aging down.
Dirk?
I think 25 years from now, you'll pick up a DVD. Well, there will not be DVDs anymore. You'll pick up a data carrier with your genome and carry it to your physician, and he will run some programs and will recognize what predispositions you have, what interventions might help you in the long run. And this will be preventive. This will not be something that fixes an acute problem, but will preempt such a problem from coming. And I think basic research into cancer, into neurodegeneration, cardiovascular research, aging, will all contribute to this type of development where preventive care will be much more important than it is now. And it will be based on a fundamental understanding of our genes, of other components of our body, such as hyaluronic acid, etc.
And when it comes to that, we'll be going in at a relatively younger age then to do that, that kind of preventive testing.
Absolutely. You look at BRCA1, for example, the gene that predisposes to breast cancer. No, young women have that done and take the consequences.
Dirk, thank you for sharing your expertise with us. We appreciate the time. Thank you very much. And Andre, Vera, so wonderful to hear and for you to help distill what's happening in the research labs. Thank you for taking the time as well.
Thank you very much for having us and spreading the word.
Oh, well, I hope that you keep coming back and see us again.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
it was our pleasure.
A short break and right back with more on Member Supported Public Radio.